When I say fire, you'll say next time. We the fire, we the fire. When I say fire, you'll say next time. We the fire, we the fire.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. And that was The Fire Next Time by Baltimore's own Son of Nun. On this day in 1963, James Baldwin published this brilliant and incendiary book by the same name, The Fire Next Time. If you haven't read it, it's one of the most important book of essays ever written. Read it. We're lucky to have C.C. McDonald with us today. C.C. McDonald is a transgender woman and actress from Minneapolis. She was released from prison earlier this month after serving 19 months for her involvement in a stabbing of this man named Dean Schmitz with a pair of scissors. Supporters of C.C. say she was defending herself against a group of people who attacked her and her friends with a bar glass in a racist and transphobic attack. She was slashed deeply on her cheek by a broken bottle. And in the altercation, Dean Schmitz was killed. C.C. was held in a men's prison, even though she identifies as a transgender woman. And she was released on January the 13th, and she joins us now by phone from Minneapolis. We're also joined by Katie Burgess, who is executive director of the Trans Youth Support Network in Minneapolis. And C.C. and Katie, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having us.
And you spent one of the things that a lot of people are curious about since you this is the kind of people have looked at this since it's happened to you and can supported you through all of this, your time in prison. I mean, the world we know the statistics around transgender people in our society, and going to prison, attacks, suicide rates, and more that happen. And you were put in a man's prison, though you fought to go to a woman's prison, right?
Actually, I decided that it would be a waste of time to actually try and get me into a woman's prison. I felt like after doing lots of research and educating myself about the prison industrial complex and how the system works, I felt like that no prison would have been safe for me, because no prison is safe for anybody. Regardless of gender or race or sexual orientation. And so we decided to focus our energies on other things, like making sure that I had the rights as a trans woman in prison, and just, you know, making sure that I wasn't being targeted or discriminated against while I was incarcerated.
So, I know prisons are one of the hardest places in the world for anybody to survive within, but we also know, and I personally know, that people who are transgender in male prisons have a very difficult time. You walked into that prison kind of a celebrity. People knew who you were. Your case was on the front pages because you'd been an activist. You stood up to these people. The fight ensued, and many people were there in court to sit to support you when you were on trial. So what about your experience inside the prison? Because life in prison for transgender people is very tough. It's very hard. I mean, as somebody who's worked in prison, who's been around that a long time, I know how difficult that is. So what was your experience like? I mean, how did you actually get through it?
Fortunately, I was blessed to have such an amazing support committee and the people who were involved, which really helped me through my time incarcerated. A lot of people in general, but especially people who are LGBTQI, don't have that type of support or advocacy from others while they're incarcerated. So for me to have people who were involved and wanted to be there for me in any way, you know, mentally and spiritually, and through advocating and support and hard work, we all went through the process together. So I felt like I wasn't alone in the case. I felt like I had a lot of people who I knew loved me and who wouldn't let me struggle in the system. So for me, any prison is hard, and it can be hard for anybody. But for me, to have that type of support, to to know that people were working hard for me outside as hard as I was working inside, because I was one girl alone, you know, advocating in the inside, and everyone was doing what they were doing on the outside. I made sure that I had the proper hormones. I made sure that I wasn't being discriminated against. I made sure that I wasn't being put into segregation because of being a transgender woman and them using it as a scapegoat to seclude me from others and everybody. I mean, it was a dual thing that took place between me and my family, which was the support committee and the people involved outside of prisons and me doing what I had to do on the inside.
I'm curious, Katie, how did you get involved in this case? What brought you into all this?
Well, Cece and I actually knew each other earlier on. You know, Cece had been an organizer with the Trans Youth Support Network some years before. We'd been relatively out of touch, but there's a pretty unique kind of political landscape here in Minneapolis on kind of multiple levels. The organization that I work for has been focusing on these issues for quite a long time, trying to find solutions to the violence that specifically young trans women of color face for over 7 years now. And part of that has been to set up a network that's the network part of the Trans Youth Support Network, a network collaborative of different social service agencies that really give us eyes and ears in a lot of different sectors like housing, you know, shelters, you know, schools, healthcare clinics. And when I heard about CC's case, I was able to get in contact with a few different social workers who were able to put me in direct contact with CC and some of her family. And it was really quite an amazing moment, I think, for me personally and for the whole community here in Minneapolis. You know, the first phone call that I had with CC while she was already in jail, having experienced pretty extreme abuse at the hands of the police directly after having experienced this really violent incident, she still had indomitable kind of faith and love for herself and for her community. You know, she said to me, "If you have faith, you can do anything." And she was, you know, at that time, experiencing all of these kinds of abuses and violence. And that was a really amazing moment for me, and taught me a lot about how to have hope.
I'm very curious about the issue of transgender rights in prisons, especially. And Cece, I know you've been a person who's fought for this most of your life. I mean, this has been part of your struggle, transgender rights. But since you've come in and out of prison, you've had a firsthand experience seeing this. I mean, now I wish you both could talk a bit about what kind of rights transgender people are fighting for inside the prison system. What is it you need to see, you want to see, has to be fought for?
Well, I know that a big issue that trans women face is being put into segregation away from general population, because a lot of times the system feels like that's the best way to protect them. And I feel like me personally speaking as a transgender woman, that it's really hard for someone to say what is protection when in society there is no one there to protect you except for you. So for you to come into this environment where everyone is talking about what's best for me and what's, you know, my protection, I get offended, because it's like I didn't go through life, you know, surviving just by living in a closet or staying in my home. You know what I'm saying? I have to experience life. I have to experience things. And I feel like, you know, for a person to tell me what's right for me and what, you know, them protecting me is really offensive to me. I think That's one thing. Also, you know, the rights for trans women to not only receive medications such as hormones and vitamins and things like that to stay healthy, but for also for people who come into prisons who then identify as trans to be able to get prescriptions for hormones and things. Because a lot of times if a person comes into prison and they identify themselves as trans within the prison but haven't had any prior medical history or prescriptions related to transitioning, they aren't allowed to get it in prison. So I feel like if a person then identifies themselves inside a prison as trans and wants to transition while in prison, that person should be able to do that. But overall, all prisons, we need to find a way to work within our communities to stop people from going to prison and to somehow abolish prisons in general. They ruin our communities, you know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? Like, the criminalization of everything tends to put more people in prisons than there's, and once you have that attachment on you as a felon, then the cycle seems to continue because, you know, there aren't many people who want to hire a felon, or there aren't many programs that are willing, as far as like housing programs and public assistance or certain things where it's easy for a person who is a felon to be discriminated against and to be caught up in that cycle of in and out of prison.
And in light of what you just heard CC say, Katie, how would you add on to that about what your struggles are around rights of transgender people in our criminal justice system?
Yeah, I mean, I think that she framed it perfectly. She identified a lot of the issues of safety that trans people experience in prison. Obviously, there's a lot of dangers and a lot of violence that trans folks experience while incarcerated, and there's a lot more trans folks who are incarcerated than we might expect. You know, 1 in 3 African-American trans women are behind bars right now. There's this kind of preponderance of different systems of oppression at play, kind of what CC was talking about, this like cyclicalness of, you know, you are already, experiencing homelessness or unemployment that leaves you at increased incidence of interaction with law enforcement. You end up incarcerated, you have a record, then it's going to be harder for you to find housing or employment. You stay in this kind of cycle. And I think what CC was getting at there, which is super important for us to hear, is that trans folks are not safe in prisons for a lot of the reasons that she listed, and that prisons in general just aren't a safe place for people, period. And that really where we have to go with this isn't necessarily just to reform how trans folks are placed in prisons or how we're given access to hormones, but really looking at the root causes of why people are in prisons at all, and to decriminalize things like drug use and sex work and poverty, the things that are clear pipelines to prison for trans folks and for people of color in general.
So the attack and fight that took place that it ended up putting you in prison, CC. I mean, I just want to talk a bit about that. I mean, not I mean that specific event, but what happens in daily lives of trans people like this, especially trans people of color, and the kind of trauma that people go to almost every day, not every day, but go to often enough in confrontations with people who just don't get it.
A lot of the issues are surrounded by trans misogyny and bigotry, ignorance around the idea of what it means to be transgender. I feel like a lot of people don't educate themselves enough to know who we are as individuals. We tend to be categorized as gay men, which is the exact opposite. And I feel like it's really offensive. And for me, took a long time for me to, you know, to grow into who I am as an individual, as a trans woman, as an African-American trans woman, because like, I grew up in Chicago and I faced lots of violence growing up there. And it took me a while to become outspoken and learn to stand up for myself and learn how to, you know, pick and choose my battles. But lots of trans women face that fear. It's a fear that people have of this unknown. And I feel like it also has to do with the way the system handles violence against trans women, because a lot of times people, or the system, I should say, can actually use that fear of being afraid of a trans person or the trans misogyny that, you know, causes people to get away with literally murder in some cases because of the ignorance and the misleading and the miseducation of transgenderism and what it means to be transgender. And I feel like if there were not more laws to protect us, but if that too, but there has to be a collective effort between, you know, cisgendered and transgender people to educate ourselves to understand, you know, the plights that trans women have to go through so that we can change the way that people, you know, treat us as women or however, you know, we identify as individuals. And I feel like for me personally, you know, trans women need to, you know, be more well educated when it comes to self-defense, when it comes to education, when it comes to things that can protect us in situations where, you know, we are targeted. You know, a lot of times it happens, you know, fortunately for me that night I was in a group, you know what I'm saying? But had I been by myself, the situation could have been totally different. And the sad part about it is it would have been his story against mine. And, you know, the system and how it works would have probably, you know, believed his story as a cisgender white male, and me being an African-American, black trans woman. And like the things that Katie touched on, you know, with the criminalization of drugs and sex work and poverty, it would have been easy for them to target me as they did during the trial. And I know that it's a lot more trans women who have experienced that.
As you were speaking, I was wondering about that night. I mean, I know that things happen in our lives that, and they, things can happen so quickly, you don't even know what's going on. And they just come at you. Obviously, that's what happened that night to you. And, I read what you said in the court about him, about Schmitz, Dean Schmitz, who died that night. And you said, I'm sure to Dean's family he was a loving, caring person, but that's not what I saw that night. I saw a racist, transphobic, narcissistic bigot who did not have any regard for my friends and I. And just in reflecting just in that about that moment, given all the social issues around it and all the pain there is of being a woman of color, a transgender person of color in this country, I mean, how do you reflect on that now? Because it's very painful. The idea, I mean, whether you see somebody die or even, especially when you're involved in another person dying, that's a very deep and heavy thing.
Exactly. And I had to deal with that situation for a long time. It took a long time for me to have to accept that I actually took someone's life, and it actually had me on the brink of suicide. Like, mm-hmm. for me to have been through that situation and knowing the person who I am, like, I never thought that would have been me. But also at the same time, I felt like if someone is trying to take my life away, I have that right to protect myself. Unfortunately, the system didn't see it that way. And, you know, I used to beat myself up about it, but, you know, again, fortunately, I had people there telling me that there's nothing wrong with protecting yourself. There's nothing wrong with valuing your life. And, you know, it's, of course, no one wants to see someone die. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't care how hateful this man was, it still was a saddening thing for me. You know what I'm saying? Like, that part really haunted me, like, for a long time. It still kind of does, because I still have, this is something that I have to live with the rest of my life. I can't just let it go, because I know that this is a significant event that happened in my life, and not only is it just a significant incident, someone died in the process. So I have to deal with that. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But also, like I said in court, and like you commented on, like, I felt like, you know, Bin Laden was a father. You know what I'm saying? But he was a heinous man. He did horrible things. So just because someone is loving and caring and kind to who they want to be caring and loving and kind to, doesn't mean that they are caring and loving kind to everyone else. Everyone isn't like that. You know what I'm saying? Like, I would have never went up to these people and did the things that they've done to me. You know what I'm saying? And it was really hard for me to wrap my brain around racism and transphobia and transmisogyny, because, you know, that significant incident made me reflect on lots of things in my life, dealing with my own issues around my own race and my own, you know, questions about life and questions about who I am as an individual, who I am as a Black person, and who I am as a transgender woman. So, you know, I have to learn to deal with those things accordingly. As far as where I'm at now, is, you know, I'm still remorseful to the family, but I mean everything that I said in that courtroom. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, I'm sorry what happened to your loved one. And, you know, I have to deal with this on my own terms. But both parties have to accept that responsibility. They wanted to put all the blame on me, but they failed to realize this man and the group of people that he was with started everything. He was the one who targeted us. He was the one who threw the racial epithets. He was the one who made all the transphobic and homophobic slurs. So why should I have to take all the brunt of what's going on? We all have to accept responsibility, and it's, and hopefully we all can learn how to handle situations and be better people and learn from this situation, because that's the only thing that we can get out of it.
And finally, very quickly, I'm just curious how you both feel. I mean, very quickly before we have to end, that do you think there can be a bridge built between people like the ones that you had the confrontation with and trans people and everybody else? Could there be a mediation? Could there be a reconciliation? Can there be a way for people to learn from this and heal?
I believe there's a way, but again, it has to be a dual effort. You know what I'm saying? Everyone has to put in their initiative, because there are lots of people in the LGBTQI community who could give a less about a straight person or what they think and feel the same way about a cisgender straight person as a, you know, a homophobic, transmisogynistic, bigoted cisgender straight person would think about us. So it's a dual effort. We all have to educate ourselves. We all have to be willing to say, okay, I'm going to be open-minded. I'm going to come in this with, you know, no holds barred. This is a situations like this where you are dealing with someone who is non-conforming and someone who doesn't identify as the next person, you have to handle that in a different light. And a lot of people aren't willing to take that chance, because we're not even, a lot of times, seen as humans. We're disgraceful. We're not good enough for society. We're not good enough for love. We're not good enough for anything. So until a person recognizes that, then there's no way for us to move forward. But I have a lot of hope and faith that we can change the way that we view each other and the way that cisgendered and cisgender heterosexual people view trans people.
And Katie, before we have to leave, you have a final thought?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think I agree with everything CeCe's saying. I have a lot of hope that we can change the way that these things are happening in our society. We are being systematically eliminated, and what happened with CeCe was that she was prosecuted for surviving that kind of violence, and the way that she defended herself, not only in the street, but also in the courtroom and in the prisons, and continues to put her story out there as an inspiration to us all and help in this kind of education that needs to happen in our community, this kind of slow-moving reconciliation that I do believe will happen over the long term. And, you know, she's working on a lot of different amazing projects right now, working on a documentary with Laverne Cox, who's the star of Orange is the New Black, or a star of Orange is the New Black, as well as continuing to work with the Trans Youth Support Network, going out and doing a lot of these kinds of educational, you know, programs. And I think that's really what's going to, you know, keep pushing our community forward.
Katie Burgess, Executive Director of Trans Youth Support Network. I'm glad you were with us. And CeCe McDonald, I'm glad you are free and out there fighting the cause. And I appreciate you taking time to talk to our listeners today.
Thank you again for having me, Mark.
On our way out, we're going to hear Chant by Public Image Limited. Fronted by John Lydon, who was born on this day in 1956.